Hello and welcome. I am Cyrus Farhangi, and today I have the honor to be speaking to General Tom Middendorp. Hello, Tom.
Hi, good to see you.
Thanks a lot for accepting my invitation. You are a retired general of the Royal Netherlands Army. You have served as Chief of Defense of the Armed Forces of the Netherlands from 2012 to 2017. So for French speakers, that means Chef d'État-Major des Armées. Today, you are the chair of the International Military Council on Climate and Security, IMCCS. You have recently published a book called The Climate General, which is a broad analysis of global security risks posed by climate change. Currently, the book is being adapted into a three-part video documentary, and you've been traveling to places like Iraq and Bangladesh. And throughout this interview, we'll be speaking about the concrete effects of climate change that you have observed as a general throughout the world, with issues such as water scarcity, etc. So the issue is highly complex, yet I found your analysis to be very rigorous, very relevant, so thanks a lot. And at the same time, I thought that you showed a lot of empathy for the victims of climate change. So the Army, Tom, is among the institutions that's most concerned about climate change. I'll share the links in the description of, for example, a paper by the Pentagon called Implications of Climate Change for the U.S. Army. In France, we also have what's called Observatoire Climat Défense. For you as an individual, can you please tell us how you gradually came to realize the global security risks posed by climate change?
Yes, I think it started in 2009. I was a commander in the south of Afghanistan of a multinational task force, and we were fighting every day. And in one village, we had very severe fighting for days to free that village from the Taliban. And we succeeded in doing that, but only to find out that there were still tensions in those villages that would allow the Taliban to return any moment. And it took a while before we found out what the source was of those tensions. And it all had to do with water. This is a very agricultural country, a lot of farmers, they all need water. But there wasn't a lot of water, so they couldn't agree on how to divide the water. And that gave tensions. And then the Taliban jumped into that and they said, okay, then we will be the referee. We will decide who gets what water. And that gave the Taliban kind of a power base over that population. And once we realized that, we flew in some water experts to negotiate a solution to divide that water. And once we came to an agreed solution, all the tensions disappeared in that village. It became very quiet. And a year later, I could take the current king of the Netherlands through the main street of that village with very limited protection, which only showed the enormous turnaround that had taken place there. And not just because of our fighting and a lot of military power that we used, but also because we realized what the root of the problem was and we addressed it. So for me, that was kind of a first eye-opener that we often fight symptoms of something that has a deeper cause and that we need to look further in our analysis, and that climate is an important element in that. And when I returned from that mission, I became director of ops in the Netherlands, of operations. And I was responsible for more than 20 missions all over the world, the Dutch participation in those missions. And I realized that it is the case in every mission. In Somalia, we were fighting pirates. But the pirates that we caught were poor farmers and fishermen who hardly had an alternative anymore, who couldn't earn their living in the way they had been doing for centuries. So we were fighting symptoms of a deeper problem, and that also had to do with the increasing droughts that killed the cattle, that pushed the farmers away from their homelands, and that drove them into the hands of criminality or other organizations like Al-Shabaab. And I also saw that in Mali, I saw that in Iraq, where water was also used as a weapon, as an instrument of power. So increasingly, I realized that climate is an enormous factor behind tensions in regions and behind conflicts. But I didn't make the link with climate change at that moment, because when you are in missions, climate is a given fact and you need to deal with it. But when I became chief of defense, I also started looking more strategically at defense and how we should develop to the future. And I realized that climate change is one of the big game changers. If it already has such an impact and it will get worse, that means that the impact will also get worse. So we identify climate change as a big game changer for the future, as a driver of change. And with that realization, we started to further build knowledge and insight on that topic.
Sure, and I'm guessing sometimes climate scientists give conferences to the military to explain sort of what the mega trends are and what the risks are.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm guessing also the people from the IPCC may have come to talk to you.
Well, no, not specifically, but we did use the analysis of the climate experts. So I'm not a climate expert, and most military are not climate experts. So we use their expertise, but what we do is translate that into the security environment. So we assess the effects that it will have on our security on a global level, a regional level, and a very local level. And the more we dive into that, the more concerned I become, and the more convinced I became that we need to do something about it. And I came to the realization that climate change is a kind of a risk multiplier, as the US call it, and is also an item of national security. And I certainly don't want to securitize the issue. It's much broader than defense. But I think the security sector should take this more seriously and has a role to play. And we need to develop that role.
At the same time, I sense that since the day that people are, and I mean civil society and companies, are understanding that climate change is not just an environmentalist cause, but it's also a security issue. And it's an issue with things like insurance. Can the world tomorrow still be insured? People are paying more attention to it than when they thought it was just about preserving the planet, which seems a bit abstract sometimes.
Indeed. And I think that's what we can bring. We can bring another perspective to the table. In the past, climate change was kind of a left-wing Green Party topic, an activist topic for a small group in our society. I think what we can help is build the bridge to the other parties and show them that this is an item to be taken seriously also from a security perspective. And others can do that on the economic aspects and others on the social aspects. So I think it's important that we translate the climate scenarios into, okay, what does it mean for our population? How does it change our world? And then it becomes more tangible for the people. And then you get more acceptance that this is maybe the biggest game changer we are facing for this century.
It is amusing that some politicians, particularly Republicans in the United States, still see this as a right-wing and left-wing thing. And Ron DeSantis has even called the U.S. military something like a woke ideology because the U.S. military takes climate change seriously. Anyway, it's just an anecdote.
But that only shows that it is important to depoliticize it. And that's a movement that I do see happening in many of the Western countries now. And when I started 7 years ago with this topic, it was a very Green Party topic. But now it's on the agenda of all political parties. So it's becoming more depoliticized, and I think that's very good.
Okay. Thanks for this introduction. We're going to discuss quite a range of topics. You mentioned water scarcity. We're going to further discuss it. We're going to discuss other climate risks that and scenarios that should be anticipated. We're going to discuss about how military strategy and operations in themselves are supposed to adapt to climate change.
Yeah.
War in a changing climate is not going to be the same as war today. We're going to talk about European powers and NATO and sort of geopolitical tensions with, let's say, Russia and Asian powers, how that plays in climate change. The second half of your book is more on the side of solutions, and we're going to discuss them. And then we'll have a conclusion about solar geoengineering, which some military are starting to talk about, even though you don't mention it in your book. But I'm curious about your view. So let's start with perhaps, so water scarcity is very much present throughout your book.
Yeah.
For instance, you refer to dams, so a barrage hydraulique in French, we refer to dams as a weapon of war. So what's your analysis of some future security hotspots that are posed by water scarcity in link to climate change?
Yeah, I think water is a key element in climate change. Yeah? What we see all over the world is that we are facing longer periods with more severe droughts and higher temperatures, and shorter periods of more intense rainfall, even in Europe. If you look at Italy last year, the one moment you have more than 40 degrees temperature, the other moment you have big hailstorms, and they kind of interchange with each other. So the weather is becoming more extreme to both sides. And what that results in, and I saw that in Afghanistan as well, that the country becomes drier in the dry periods. And once it rains, you have too much rain and it just flushes away. And a few weeks later, it's dry again. So the soil cannot absorb the water that is coming as they could in the past, which means that the fertility of the soil is being affected, which immediately has an impact on food security. So both water and food security is at stake in many, many countries in the world, which is a very basic need for populations. And what do you do if there is no food and no water? You have to move. So that leads to migrations, that leads to internal tensions, etc. So water is a big element, and rivers are kind of the lifelines of countries. If you look at a famous example is, of course, the River Nile in Egypt. And the whole population of Egypt lives along the Nile. The rest of the country is hardly inhabited. They all live at the Nile, but more upstream you have Ethiopia, and they are building a big Renaissance dam to hold the water for themselves. And you can imagine that that gives tensions between those countries. They both want to secure water, but they are competing about the access, so that can easily turn into conflicts, these kind of tensions. Until now they have been able to settle that peacefully. But once it becomes more eminent and more being felt by the population, people become more desperate, that can easily turn to the worse. And the same I saw in Iraq, where I was at the beginning of this year, with the Tigris River. The Tigris River comes out of Turkey. In the north of Iraq, there is a big dam, the Mosul Dam, and the dam was an important place during the fight against Daesh, against the Islamic State. And it was occupied by Daesh. And they used that dam as an instrument of power. So Daesh occupied the dam and they gave the population a choice. Either you cooperate with us or you don't get any water. So they had they used the distribution of water as a forceful element to force people to cooperate. And the people had hardly had a choice because they cannot live without the water. Luckily, the dam could be recaptured within a few weeks, but it only shows that these dams are very vulnerable, vital pieces of infrastructure that can be utilized in conflicts. And I visited the dam a few weeks ago, and what I saw is that the whole water supply of Iraq is now in harm's place. The dam only contains 20% of its capacity. The power generator at that dam could not be used because there was not enough water in the dam. And this is the winter period. This is the wet season. So, and the whole Tigris River depends upon the water coming from that dam. And the Tigris River supplies a large part of Iraq with water. It's a lifeline for the whole country. So, yeah, you can imagine the enormous disruption that can bring if it further dries out. And I saw that happening already in Iraq. I saw farmers having to leave their lands. I saw how the city of Mosul has doubled in size in a few years' time because they all moved to the city and cannot find work. And I saw how the refugees were being housed and how that gave tensions within that population. So it has an enormous disruptive effect on countries. And another last example I would like to give is in South Asia. You have the Himalaya Mountains, the Tibetan Plateau, but all the rivers in South Asia, from Pakistan to China itself, through all the countries, they all come from this high region. The Tibetan Plateau is the third polar cap of the world. So there's a lot of glaciers, a lot of snow there, but that snow is also melting, which results in all kinds of floodings and river floodings. And interestingly, this is all Chinese territory. So what China is doing now, they are building dams, a lot of dams. They now have plans for 100 additional dams on top of all the dams that are already there. And then I see, when I looked through a security lens to that, I see Nord Stream pipelines. These are all live lines for different countries, these rivers. But in the future, China controls the flow of water for the whole region, which gives them an enormous instrument of power over all these countries. So also there you see this element of dependency that can be misused as an element of power by those who control it, as we also saw in Ukraine, where Putin used the Nord Stream pipeline for oil as a kind of a power tool towards the West, which created an energy crisis in our countries. And the same China can do with the water distribution in that region. So water is becoming a very dominant factor between climate change and insecurity and conflicts.
If I may add a last risk, and we don't mean here to spread anxiety and depression, but it's actual documented risks, is around sea level rise and, among other risks, salinization of deltas. You were mentioning the Nile.
Yeah.
It's among the main deltas, and even a 1 meter sea level rise will already salinize major land surfaces, which are quite strategic from an agricultural point of view. A lot of farmers have settled around delta zones, which are particularly prone to agriculture.
Yeah.
And it's not just the Nile, but also the Mekong, the Indus, the Niger Delta. So these are hundreds of millions of people living around there and depending on these deltas for subsistence.
Yeah, you're completely right. So it affects food production, agriculture in those regions. We have the same in the Netherlands. Also here, the salination is increasing into our soil, which affects farmers to grow their crops. And you see that in that region too. And what's also interesting in the South Asian region is that most of the mega cities in the world are concentrated in that region. These are cities with twice as much inhabitants as the whole of my own country in one city. And they are all located at rivers and at coastal areas. So just imagine the impact that sea level rise can have on those regions. And this is also the factory of the world. Here are the low-wage countries where most of the products that we used to a large extent are being built. So if that is disrupted, it will also have enormous economic effects on our countries. So we cannot close our eyes for what's happening in that region and how climate change affects those regions.
Of course. Again, you're the chair of the International Military Council on Climate and Security. So with you pretty much trying to sensitize politicians worldwide on the issues that we're discussing here. You mentioned in your book that, again, perhaps 7, 8, or 10 years ago, I don't remember exactly, you felt like you were preaching in the desert, like you were like, I think you said, Don Quixote fighting windmills.
Yeah.
Don Quixote qui se bat contre des moulins à vent. Anyway, but today you feel like there's more attention and these threats are being taken seriously.
Yeah.
Can you perhaps give examples of scenarios, threats that you're trying to push for anticipation? I mean, it can include failing states, population displacements, conflicts around Arctic resources. I mean, whichever topic you want to discuss now.
No, sure. But let me start with this network. When I stopped as a chief of defense, I was the first active serving general to address climate change publicly. I've been chief of defense for 5.5 years. And we had many meetings per year with all the chiefs of defense of NATO and EU. And the word climate has not been mentioned once in any of those meetings. which only showed that we had a long way to go. So I was the first to publicly address this at the World Forum in The Hague, which gave a lot of fuss in the Netherlands. People were annoyed and there were a lot of political turmoil. How can the chief of defense address climate change and stress the importance of climate change, which is a left-wing topic? The environmental groupings were upset because I was hijacking their topic to improve the defense budget. And so all kinds of turmoil. And so in the beginning, I really felt like a very lone fighter. But I found out that there are many people around the world, military leaders, who shared my concern. And what we did at a conference, at the Planetary Security Conference, with a few research institutes, we thought, let's organize that. And let's bring those people together. So we created this network called the IMCCS. It has a difficult word, International Military Council on Climate and Security, but it's not a standing organization. We don't have a building. We don't have people in our service. It's a network. And it's a network of security leaders from more than 40 countries around the world. And this is very interesting because they come from all the regions in the world and they bring different experiences. They bring different best practices that we can exchange amongst each other, which also shows that climate change can be an element of cooperation. If you look at it professionally. And so we tried to bring that together, and the inputs of those experts was being used by four research institutes in the US and in Europe, one in Paris, two in the Netherlands, and one in Washington. And they published the reports that we published. They made those reports. And what I do is I take that scientific effort towards NATO, towards the EU, towards institutions, towards nations, to make them more aware of the climate security nexus and to support them in their policy development. And that picked up speed over time, because when you talk on behalf of a global organization, people listen to you. If you talk on behalf of yourself, they hardly listen to you. So that really helped to raise the voice. And we created a platform in the Munich Security Conference, which is the biggest conference in the world on security. And they accepted us to put climate on the agenda. And this was the first time ever that they had that topic on the agenda. So I was sitting in a forum with John Kerry and with Greenpeace and Ban Ki-moon. And here we talked about climate and security. And from that moment on, the ball started rolling. And it became an increasingly important topic. And it's good to see now that NATO has fully embraced this topic and made it to a top priority. They want to be world leading on the issue of climate and security, and which only shows that by uniting in a network, you can really bring a lot of change in the world. You can really have an effect together. I'm very pleased to see that happen. So I wasn't a lone fighter anymore. The scenarios that we look at are different kind of levels. The first level is the global level. On the global level, I think we need to place climate change in the context of two other main trends. And one is the population growth. We have a world population that's almost doubling in size in this century. We at the beginning of the century, we had 6 point something billion. We are now at 8. So in 23 years, we have grown more than 30% in our world population. And that will increase till the end of the century to about 11 billion, according to the UN. After that, it will decrease again. But we are facing an almost doubling world population, which means also a doubling demand for water, for food, for all kinds of goods, but also for arable space and for livable space. On the other side, we have resource scarcity, increasing resource scarcities, an increasing range of resources becoming scarce. So the big question of this century is, how are we going to bridge that gap between demand and supply? And climate change makes it very hard to bridge that gap because climate change limits our possibilities to do that. And for me, one thing is for sure, if you want to supply a doubling world population with water, food, and goods, we cannot do that in the way we are producing now, because then we will only deplete our resources more quickly. We are on a kind of a dead-end street. which means that we need to change our production models and our products into more circular models. We need to become more resource independent, because else we will only create more competition, global competition around resources and access to resources, which will turn in all kinds of conflicts. So this is the overall challenge on a global level. On a regional level, we see a lot of disruption because of climate change. And I already mentioned several examples. Especially the Sahel region is a very familiar example, where we see that the increasing droughts affect the perspective of life of people. And what choices do they have? If your cattle is dying, your farmlands are drying out, you don't have much choice. So you either have to move away, you migrate to the cities or to neighboring countries or to Europe, or you go look for alternative jobs. But alternative jobs are not much there. And then you can earn easy money in criminality or in extremism. So these countries also become kind of breeding grounds for extremist organizations and for organized crime organizations. So we see, and we see that happening in Africa now. We see one country after the other collapsing. We see all kinds of coups taking place. We see extremism growing up. And we see more human weapon and drugs trafficking through that region. And that all at some point ends on our streets.
It is a bit saddening because I remember up until the 90s, Africa was at war, many, many civil wars. So we remember Rwandan genocide, Liberian child soldiers, dozens of examples like that. And 2000s and early 2010s, it seemed to be going towards a way to prosperity. But yet this seems to be unfortunately reversing. I don't know what examples you're thinking about, but things like Nigeria and Ethiopia and seem to be increasingly unstable, whereas they seemed to be going towards a better direction until something like 10 years ago.
And also Central Africa, also Burkina Faso, which was a very peaceful country. And they are now turning away from that. And what I saw when I was in Somalia last week was that how big that change is of climate change. We often underestimate the impact. But in these countries, they had very secure rain seasons. Over the century, every year, however hot it was, they had several months of rain season. And that has changed very abruptly in the last 10 years. Somalia, over the last 5 years, only had 2 rain seasons and 3 years without rain. So just imagine the impact that has. And most of the cattle has died, and the economy runs on cattle and cattle trade. So it has an enormous effect on those countries. And that also gives an enormous destabilizing effect within those countries. Because people become desperate. They don't know what to do. They become unsatisfied with the government. The government cannot solve it. So they are very open for all kinds of other influences. And for me, that's a very big concern, especially in the Sahel region, but also in countries like Iraq. So that's more on the regional level. So on the regional level, we will see that climate change is a very big disruptor of local stability. Which also affects us. It has all these effects that I just described, but it also affects our supply chains. Around the world, the resource scarcity, this regional instability means that the supply towards our country of all kinds of resources and goods is hampered because of these effects. And so it also has an effect on our economies. And the third level I would like to mention of impacts where we look at are more the natural disasters. And these are the floodings, the wildfires, the hurricanes, etc. And several years ago, France and the Netherlands, we were both confronted with a big hurricane in Saint Martin, as we call it, where almost all the infrastructure of the island was wiped away. And that only showed the devastating impact of such a hurricane. And we see the hurricane seasons becoming longer and more intense. So we can expect more and more of these severe weather events. And on the global scale, one of the insurance company had calculated that last year we had $350 billion on damages globally. And then those were only the larger severe weather events. So it's an enormous disturbing factor costing a lot of money, $350 billion in a year. The US alone had $66 billion of damages because of larger disasters in their country. So it's also becoming an economic factor. And there is a lot of crisis management involved once there is a severe weather event, which leads to an increased call upon the military to support, as we did in Saint-Martin. So also for the military, this becomes more relevant that they need to provide human security and human support and disaster relief. So on these three levels, I think we can expect big changes in our in the security environment because of climate change.
Yes, your last point is a perfect transition to the next point I wanted to raise with you, which is how military strategy, missions, operations are going to have to adapt to climate change, which is a topic that we have already discussed on this show with Angélique Pal and Edouard Joly, something like 2.5 years ago. So they are researchers at IRSEM, which is, let's say, the French National Institute for Military Strategy Research. But yeah, I wanted to have your point of view, because obviously it's a very broad topic on how the military is going to change throughout climate change.
Yeah, I think the military can and should change on three different areas. One is on knowledge. We need to build a knowledge base to understand the effects of climate change. We need to understand them better to... So, which means that we need to integrate that into our intelligence analysis. If you realize that climate change increasingly is becoming a driver of conflicts, then it makes sense to integrate that into the analysis of potential conflict areas, because it helps you to better understand the dynamics of those conflicts. And that helps you to better address those conflicts or be part of addressing those conflicts. So on the intelligence side, I think we can also support civil services in forecasting. We can put the security element into forecasting. We can help them to forecast where will climate change lead to migration flows, where will it lead to instability, where will it lead to more extremism. We can bring the security dimension to the table in the wider whole of government assessments that are taking place. So that's one big area, and that also helps the military themselves to better understand what they are facing. A second area would be on adaptation, and adaptation has an internal side and an external side. And the internal side is that it becomes increasingly important for militaries to climate-proof their organization. Military need to be able to operate in any climate circumstance, whether it is severe cold or extreme hot or in flooding conditions. In all these conditions, they need to be able to operate, which means that you need to translate that into the requirements of your future capabilities. And also the soldiers need to be able to operate in extreme heat. And that also puts a different kind of demand on the clothing and on all the equipment that they are wearing, to enable them to operate in these kind of circumstances. And that's what I mean with climate proofing our organization. So what I see several countries doing now is that in all the policy development within their defense organizations, they add a climate lens to it. Every policy that they develop, they also look from a climate perspective to see if this policy is complete enough or some elements should be added to that policy. And that's also part of the climate proofing. So we are climate proofing policies, but also equipment, or that needs to be done. Not all countries are doing that. And the external element of adaptation is more that we support fragile regions around us to become more resilient against climate change. In the Sahel region that we just talked about, we can wait for it to happen, for these countries to collapse and then intervene. But then you are very reactive. We can also support them more proactively in becoming more resilient against climate change, which means that the military can be a supporting player in big adaptation programs for those regions. And we can help, for instance, the security sector in those countries to become more climate sensitive, to become more able to operate in these extreme climate conditions. We can partner with them to make sure that they deal with the tensions coming from climate change in the right way, without destabilizing the country. So I think new kinds of partnerships are needed with those regions, also from a security perspective, to help them resist the effects of climate change. And that's a role that the military could play, but that they still need to develop, because at this moment we are hardly doing that. And a large role that the military could play is on mitigation, which also has to do with reducing the footprint of the military. And here, this is mostly a technological question. How can we reduce our footprint? And what I try to explain to the military is that there are huge opportunities there. If you can use the new technologies that are now popping up to become more self-sufficient in your operations, then you can take away a lot of the logistical support that we are now providing. And logistics is the biggest cost driver of any military mission. It's also a big vulnerability of a mission. We are transporting millions of tons of goods through dangerous areas to our units, which is an enormous cost factor and a risk factor. And the more you can reduce that dependency, the more operational effective you are, the less vulnerable you are. And that can be done on energy, if you use local energy production. That can be used on water, if you do use local water production. And there are new technologies to extract water from the air, as I describe in my book. That can be used on 3D printing of spare parts, on more remote support, medical support, using robotics, like hospitals are doing. So in many ways, you can reduce the logistical footprint of units and make them more independent, which also has an enormous operational benefit. So on mitigation, I think defense can also be a platform for innovation. If we design a future naval vessel and we design it in such a way that it is more self-sufficient, then that same technology can be used in the civil sector as well. So in that sense, the defense could also be a platform for innovations. So these are some of the roles that we could play.
Of course.
And last but not least, of course, is the whole disaster relief role, to support civil authorities in dealing with all kinds of natural disasters.
Regarding your second point, particularly on internal climate adaptation, I've also read that quite a number of military facilities with only a 1 meter sea level rise, they were under threat.
Yeah.
And it's a significant portion of military facilities that are coastal.
Yeah. I think that's also the case in the private sector. When they look at their supply lines, I see that climate change is more and more integrated in their risk management. So if they look at facilities in other countries, they need to take into account, are these facilities vulnerable to floodings, to sea level rise, etc., or do we need to choose another location? And the same is for the military. The biggest naval base in the world is Norfolk in the US. And already the whole fleet there has to sail several times per year because of floodings. And we are just at the beginning of sea level rise. So it affects coastal facilities, it affects harbors, it affects radar stations on the coastal lines, but also low-lying countries, like in my country, where one third of the whole country is below the sea level. Also there, you have to look, okay, where do I put my vital infrastructure and how can I protect them in case of floodings?
We can talk a bit about geopolitics and NATO. So I don't think it's pessimistic to say that the world is being increasingly fragmented. So the sort of trend has reversed over the last 10 or 20 years. Before that, the world seemed to be increasingly friendly. Russia is only one example. How do you perceive and anticipate the role of NATO and European military powers in the future? Should we rather anticipate rivalry or cooperation with, well, let's not say Russia, but at least rising Asian powers? I mean, what's your analysis of what's going on here?
Yeah. Well, no, that's a very fair point. I mentioned three big trends earlier, but the fourth big trend is, of course, the geopolitical side. And here we see a change from a globalizing world, where everybody was doing business with everybody, which also kept us a bit stable. And we are now changing to a more fragmenting world with all kinds of power blocks that start competing with each other. And especially when resources become more scarce, this competition becomes more severe. And this competition also affects the effectiveness of multilateral mechanisms. The whole UN is based on a consensus model. Now, one country can block all the decision-making. And that will increasingly happen in a more fragmenting world, which means that these multilateral mechanisms lose their power. So where's the UN in Ukraine? Where's the UN in Gaza? They are hardly a player anymore. So we need to reinvent our multilateral mechanisms to find new answers to the future. But on the short term, I'm afraid that tensions will only rise because we are all so dependent on resources that the only way every power bloc is securing the access to their resources, which means that we are on a road to more competition. On the longer term, what I see the need for more cooperation. And I hope that climate change can be a uniting factor because we are all facing the same problem. If we cannot deal with this together, we end up in more fighting against each other, which is not a solution. So I think it can work both ways. It can work as a deteriorating factor that it leads to more competition, but it can also be a driver for more cooperation because we can only solve this together and we are facing the same problem.
Thanks, Tom. So you mentioned solutions several times, and that's what the second half of your book is all about. So it's a call to action for climate change adaptation and mitigation. You put forward the idea of declaring war against climate change, which resonates with me because some economists are calling for, you know, going into a war economy. So mobilizing all the economy for fighting against climate change. So that includes both radical technological changes, changes in the global economy, in our lifestyles. So our audience is mostly familiar with such notions. I mean, I spend every day talking about renewable energy and nuclear and et cetera. One point your book mentions, which is perhaps less usual for me, is the wealth that represents indigenous knowledge in developing countries in particular. Could you perhaps elaborate on that? And because you've been in contact with all kinds of peoples worldwide, and how indigenous knowledge may help us get through this.
Yeah. I think it's important that we don't underestimate what the knowledge the local populations have. They have much more knowledge on the problems in their lands than we have. And we might be smart in technologies, but it doesn't mean that we can solve their problems. We need their knowledge to solve those problems. And what I learned also in my missions is the importance of cultural awareness. And what we often do wrongly is that we impose Western solutions on countries that work in a different way. We build Western hospitals, but without educating people to work in it, we put them on the wrong place. We have built water wells in places where they were not accepted by local populations. I got a hiccup. So it's very important to have this cultural awareness and use that local knowledge. And it's also important once you create adaptation plans that you do it in a way that you have local acceptance and local ownership, so that it becomes their solution and not our solution. So the local involvement is very important also to make sure that if you put a solution in place, that it is being done in a way that it doesn't create tension, but that it solves tensions. And that can only be done by the people themselves, because they understand how that works. So we have to be very, very cautious by imposing all kinds of Western programs and Western solutions on those countries. That's what I mean to say. And I also saw very interesting examples of people finding own solutions. In the Tibetan area, they were also facing long periods of droughts, and they built big ice pyramids. So in the very cold periods, they used water plumbing to freeze an increasing mountain of ice. And in the summertime, that ice melts, but gives a kind of supply of water for that village. So these are very ingenious local solutions that help them out of that problem. And I think these kind of solutions we can also learn from.
Thanks, Tom. And the last point I wanted to raise with you, I mean, it's not addressed in your book because you can't address all the subjects in the world, but I was curious to have your thoughts about solar geoengineering. So perhaps not just solar geoengineering, because there's also experiments in places like China. So it's the Sky Rivers project, which aims to control clouds, which may, I guess, pose some issues with India around stealing clouds or whatever. I don't really know where that project is, but in any way, things are taking sort of this turn, which raises a whole range of environmental, ethical issues, as well as, of course, geopolitical and perhaps military issues related to geoengineering. Yeah. Things like, could geoengineering someday be used as a weapon? Could it be weaponized? I'll let you just take it from whatever angle you like.
Yeah. No, I didn't describe it because it was very early stages at that moment, but I do see it increasing now. And I think this is an area that should be an area of cooperation. Because if you start geoengineering in space or in the atmosphere, you not just influence the atmosphere and the weather patterns in your own country, but also in neighboring countries. And if separate countries are doing that independently from each other, you get all kinds of contradictory effects, which can be very dangerous. And another dangerous element is when you cannot turn it around. If you put all kinds of reflecting materials in our atmosphere to reflect the sun, once it reflects too much, for instance, and becomes colder here, you cannot turn that around anymore. So you need to be very, very cautious with these kind of experiments, and it can easily become a source of tensions between countries. So I think this is by far an area of cooperation where we need to cooperate scientifically, also to better understand the second order effects, because you might be able to reduce temperature with it or create more rain with it. But what are other effects that will occur? You really have to investigate that very thoroughly to make sure that it doesn't hamper all kinds of second-order effects that work very negatively. And you have to also see how can we regulate it. If it's too much, can we decrease it again so that we can keep it under control? If it becomes uncontrollable, we just create a new climate crisis. So I see a lot of danger in it. At the same time, there might be a lot of potential in it, but it only calls for a very thorough kind of research.
Mm. Yeah, I would rather see it as a solution of last resort, even though some people, including scientists, are, let's say, pushing it also perhaps as a preventive solution, for example, to avoid a tipping point. So not wait for things to get too bad, but obviously the research is not advanced enough, so hopefully we don't start with such a thing before at least 15 or 20 years. But again, it's things like that are starting to emerge in some political discussions, mostly in the US, but Europe doesn't seem to be that active yet. But yeah, it's a topic that I address quite often in my blog, and I feel a bit lonely address
yeah, yeah.
But I'm trying to address every issue.
But we can also engineer more on a bottom-up level. I'm, for instance, connected with an initiative called the Weather Makers, and what they do is they have a plan to re-green the Sinai Desert using the fertility that's in the ground. There used to be a lot of rivers in that area, but these rivers are gone and the rain is gone. And what they want to do is to dig up the fertile grounds and start from the coastal area to create more fertility. And with vegetation that is more resilient against salination, start to create a greening process. It's a $100 million program, multi-year program, but it has been investigated scientifically very, very extensively, and everybody is convinced that it can work. And once you create a new green area, you get different kinds of patterns of clouds. So now all the moisture that evaporates into the air is just being blown away. But if you get different kind of cloud shaping, then it won't be blown away. It will be blown against the mountains and the rain will return. So they are looking at this kind of turning a negative spiral of increasing droughts into a more positive spiral of bringing the rain back into the country. It's a very interesting experiment. It's also a kind of geoengineering, more a regreening project.
Right.
But I have more faith in these kind of projects.
Right. And it's less frightening than what we were discussing earlier, because it's more sort of traditional regenerative processes like reforestation or hydrological regeneration, which is a topic we've discussed on this show with hydrologists in the past. So, paste the links again, the interviews with Charlène Descollonges and Simon Ricard, who have an NGO that supports territories mostly in France towards hydrological regeneration. And it includes the projects mostly with farmers and cities to, let's say, work on water cycles. And they mention exactly what you mentioned, is that trees and forests generate their own rain.
Yeah.
Great.
And sometimes solutions can be very simple. I don't know if you know the NGO called Just Dig It.
No.
They work in several African countries, and they learn farmers how to hold on to water. So just dig big holes in certain patterns, and once in the rain season, you can hold on to the water for a longer period, and that brings the green areas back into the region. If you look at the pictures from 5 years ago and the pictures from now, you see an enormous difference to the positive. And these are very simple solutions that can be used in many areas.
Great. I mean, I'm guessing, would you have any sort of conclusive words? I'll let you conclude. I mean, we've been discussing for an hour. It's been fascinating. And obviously, I recommend everyone to read your book, because we've gone over some aspects of it, but obviously it's something like 350 pages, and there's a lot of details on tensions that we're talking about solutions. But perhaps I'll let you give a general word of conclusion.
Yeah, well, what I try to do in the book is to explain the security climate nexus by using stories. So I use many examples, many best practices. And one half of the book is about the problem, how is climate change affecting security. The other half is about solutions, because I don't want to paint a dooming picture. I'm a positive guy. I'm an optimist. I believe I have faith in our survival capabilities, in our innovative power. And I want to stimulate people to look at that, to find solutions. And I think we need to mobilize more potential in our countries, also in the new generations. I don't know how it is in France, but if I look at our educational system, we are preparing our children for the problems of the past, but not for the problems of the future. I think if climate change is one of the biggest challenges we are facing, it should be fully mainstreamed in our educational system as well. And we need to prepare our children and the future generations to be able to deal with it. So there is a big change being asked from us, not only from the security side, but from all sides of our societies. And I hope that this book can help to explain what the security effects of climate change can be and what we could do about it.
To sort of answer your question, so I teach classes aside of my work, and when they're 22, 23, they have some notions, but there's still a lot of work. And when they're 18, they don't know much about everything that we've discussed today. So educational work to be done. Thanks a lot, Tom. Again, congratulations for your career and for your for being brave, I guess, because it's a dangerous job. It's been an honor to talk to you.
You're welcome. Thank you.